Hi, everybody. It's actually really nice to come up here to Scotland, not just because my kids aren't here. I love my children. But I'm happy they're not here. No, actually, I was thinking, oh, actually, it'd be nice if I brought my older son, but then my younger son would be unhappy. So I couldn't just bring one and not the other. They're slightly inseparable. But I'm going to take this. Is this okay? Oh, I'm not going to take that. I have to take it from the bottom. I see. Or may I just take that really short one, because that's about my height. No, just kidding. It's fine. It's okay. I am quite short, though. So yes, this is actually only my second time in Scotland, sadly enough. After 21 years in this country, I finally made it up here twice. And I feel bad because it's only Alex and Betty that managed to convince me to come up here, even though I've known, like, the whole family for ages. So I think talking to Alex about the retreat and talking about some of the things that the church has been going through and you guys have been going through, we wanted to talk and think about what it means that to have this kind of full life. And the first kind of talk that we have is this idea of, you know, that actually what happens when your life is too full. When there's too many things kind of going on in your life that just becomes really difficult to try to manage all the time. And I think one of the hardest parts, I think, with life is there's just so many things going on that you can't actually keep track of everything, right? So it becomes really difficult. So I don't know if you, do you know this person? Okay, so this is a good friend of mine. No, just I don't really know who she is. This is Marie Kondo. What she's most famous for is helping people to organize their lives in town. So she's this Japanese woman who now has a Netflix special, and she's all about organizing and folding things into thirds. And then the thing she says is, I won't do an accent because that would be racist, but she says, does this spark joy in your life? If it does not spark joy, you should throw it out. So, of course, lots of children are now homeless on the streets as their parents threw them out of the house. But Marie Kondo, so when I first saw the Netflix trailer for this, I was like, oh, my wife would be really interested in this. Because, you know, actually, I'm very messy. My wife is more neat. And then the more I thought, I said, honey, don't you want to watch this? And she's like, no, I'd rather watch Star Trek Discovery. And then I started realizing, oh, actually, my wife does not need to watch this because my wife, this is my wife, she is like already Marie Kondo level. She's already super awesome at keeping things tidy and organized. So she's somewhat of an organizational genius. I'm convinced that she could write her own book on this thing. So she keeps everything really tidy and really neat, and she's what I would call an organizational genius. What is interesting is I am not an organizational genius. This is me, and I am slightly less organized compared to my wife. This is my wardrobe. I have someone's will, like, in the bottom of my shelf. On the top, there's, like, an unopened Lego set. My wife doesn't know that I just threw clothes in there. She's always shouting at my kids, you can't just throw clothes in there. And I just keep my mouth very quiet, like, don't look at my. And then, like all men, this is my nightstand. It's just filled with cables. And I don't know why there's a light bulb in there. It's a random kind of conglomeration. Now, I'm what I call organizationally challenged. Like, I have difficulties. So what used to happen is I used to have a study, and I would have my papers there, and I would have, like, just an assortment of stuff. And then I would go away to a conference, and then while I was away, my wife would tidy that room. And she would, like, throw stuff away, and she'd, like, clean it up, and I'd come back and, like, where's all my stuff? What happened to everything? She's like, there's, like, all sorts of things in there. I found, like, some leftover food. You have to, and she's like, aren't you going to thank me for cleaning up your stuff? Like, it's like, no, I'm furious because I don't know where anything is anymore. And she's always trying to organize my things, and I'm always trying not to. So she'll do it in a very gentle way by saying, you know that drawer next to you? What's happening with that? Are you doing something? Do you need all those cables in there? And I'm always like, yeah, I'm a guy. I need cables. I need all sorts of cables of all different sizes. You have a bag of bags. I'm allowed to have as many cables as I want. And she just says, I hate cables. I hate them. I don't want to see them ever. And I was like, okay. Well, we'll leave that. So the hard part is, because we're so different, trying to understand how we organize, like she always wants to organize my life, and I always want to just kind of leave it to be kind of scattered. The thing is, when we look at our own lives and we look at the kind of things that we have in our lives to kind of organize our own time, let's say we have our studies or we have children or we have marriage or we have our work, or I don't know the keys for a house or all these things, or time for the toilet, which is also very important. We're always trying to figure out, well, actually, what's the best way to kind of organize our life and organize our time? So I remember when my wife and I first got married, it was fine, but when we had kids, everything changed because we actually needed to be more organized about things. And it'd be like, well, we need to set aside time for this, and we set aside time for this, and set aside time for this. And because the way we think about it, we always think about we have a set amount of time in a day. How do we apportion it out into kind of a way? So we'll say, well, we need to spend like some percentage of time here, some percentage of time with this, some percentage of time with this. And then you try to make this all kind of work. Yeah, I mean, I found that after having kids, I spend a lot more time in the toilet. Just, I don't want to come out. I just want to stay there for a long time. I don't care. And it's difficult because I know one of the hardest things when we got married, after we had kids, was I realized the time that my wife had for me was like reduced to zero. And I was just now an employee of my child, and my direct line manager was my wife. And there was a lot of, can you do this? Why haven't you done this? And you know, like before you have kids, you can do your laundry like once a week, and then after you have kids, you're doing two loads a day. And it was like, how come there's so much laundry to be done, and how come there's no way to dry it in this country? And it's just very challenging. The thing is, we probably spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to organize our life. And we think our life is too full. No matter what you try to do, it seems like it's just not able to get it under control. And it gets harder when you start thinking about, well, I had ambitions of what my life would be like. You know, I wanted to make amount of money. I wanted to have a house. Or I wanted to do something in my career. I wanted to be successful. And there's this feeling of being successful or wanting to be successful. At the flip side, there's I also want the best for my kids, but I also want them to learn a lot of instruments, but I also want them to come to church. I also want them to enjoy church, but I also want them to serve in church. Sometimes they're not the same. There's a whole bunch of kind of areas, and we're just trying to figure out, I have no more time. I have no more energy. How do I kind of organize this all together? And so I want to look at the passage today, actually two kind of passages, and kind of think about this. And it's a famous one. It's probably, if you've been in church for any period of time, you'll probably know it. But it's the one about building your house on the rock as opposed to the sand. So it starts off like this in Luke chapter 6. It says, so why do you keep calling me Lord, Lord, when you don't do what I say? I will show you what it's like when someone comes to me, listens to my teaching, and then follows it. So this is just before he talks about that parable of the building your house on a good foundation or on the sand. And he starts off by saying, why do you call me Lord, Lord, when you don't do what I say? Now, this made me really think of the relationship between me and my wife. So between me and my wife, there is this question that keeps coming up, which is, who's the boss? Who's really in charge? And I remember just recently one of the university students said to me, well, it's clear who wears the pants in your family, or the trousers in this family. We both wear pants. I don't wear dresses in public. So there's this question of actually, well, who's really in charge of things? And one of the hardest parts of actually when we first had kids was realizing that I don't really know that much about raising children, but my wife seems to have read a lot. So I had to just listen to whatever she would say to do. Can you do this? Can you do this? Can you be quiet? Can you not do this? Can you put these away? And that went on for 3 or 4 years, and then we had another one, and then it just started all over again. And in my heart, I started to get more frustrated or more bitter or more agitated about this. Like, well, how come I never get to say what I want to do, or how can I ever say what I think is important? And you know, who's really in charge here? And there becomes this kind of conflict or this kind of tension that shows up. For example, even when we try to organize things, my wife is actually super organized, and she's really good at it. If I took her advice, actually, my life would probably be a lot better, but I resist. It's almost as if my drawer of wires is my silent rebellion against her life. Like, I'm gonna keep this, and you can't do anything about it. I am quite worried that when I get back home, all those wires are going to be thrown away. And she'll be like, look what I did for you. I was like, no, that was the last FireWire 400 cable in the world. What am I going to do with that? So it's almost like there is this resistance and this almost sense of like, actually, you know what? Let me do things my way. You do things your way, I'll do things my way, and that's fine. I'm happy to do it that way, and you just have to deal with it. Now, if we bring that tension into our relationships around us already, in our friendships, in our workplaces, in our families, it becomes, hello, come on in, hi. Oh, I haven't seen her yet, only in photos. Everyone's scared of the middle. And it's like, you can't really be there because you're escape. You have to slide down. She has to escape with the baby at some point. All right, that's fine. No, it's okay. There's not much content here anyways. So anything that can help draw out the time, then at least I feel like you'll get your money's worth. So in this kind of question, it's this this thing, you know, let me do things my way. Let me do things the way I want to do it. And I don't care about what you think. See, we take that same kind of attitude into our marriage where we have a fight or a conflict. So the other thing that's happened recently is I've started to learn how to cook. So my wife works a little bit longer, so she's working till quite late. So I now do all the pickups of the kids, and I do all the cooking. So I cook Monday to Friday, and I'll pick up the kids. And since then, I've started to learn how to cook. I've actually gotten much better at it. I used to only cook two dishes. One was like a spaghetti bolognese, but I just used pasta, and I'd make a big batch of it, and the next day I would pour it all into a tray and turn it into a tray bake, and then that's it. But now I've learned how to cook all sorts of things, and now my wife is like, oh, actually, I think you cook better than me. So when we're both in the kitchen together, it gets a bit tense, because I'm like, oh, are you going to do it that way? And she's like, don't tell me how to cut this. And I'm like, no, I'm just asking. Do you want me to do this? No, I don't want you to do that. I was like, okay, well, should I just go away? And there's this, again, this tension where, well, I want to do things my way. This is what I'm used to. This is where I'm comfortable. And this is what I think is the best way to do it. The problem is when we bring that same kind of attitude into our relationship with God. So the way that passage starts off is, why do you call me Lord, Lord, when you don't do what I say? And it brings us to that question, well, actually, you know, who is the Lord of your life? Is if Jesus really is the Lord of your life, you have to say, okay, the word Lord itself means you are the one in charge, you are the one above me, you are the one in control. And I can't always be fighting against you because I think that my way of doing it is better. Now, the passage goes on, and you'll kind of understand why it's so important to understand Christ as your Lord as you see this. So it says, it's like a person building a house who digs deep and lays foundation on solid rock. When the flood riders rise and break against that house, it stands firm because it is well built. But anyone who hears and doesn't obey is like a person who builds a house right on the ground without a foundation. When the floods sweep down against that house, it will collapse into a heap of ruins. Now, when you read this, you start understanding, the way I would kind of put this out is, when the pressure gets too great, do things start to crumble? In other words, when the storms come or when the difficulty comes, do things start to crumble? And this is when you start to understand, knowing who is in charge makes the biggest difference when there comes to a time of conflict or pressure. So when we had our first son, I feel really bad for him because as parents, we did not know what we were doing. And my wife had read this book and she said, this is the way to do it. And we were she was convinced, I'm gonna blame her. She was convinced that if we did it this way, our child would be calm and quiet and, you know, well-demeanored. Let me see, there's so much shouting going on in the house between me and my wife, like, I don't think it's working. No, the book says it should work this way. He's already like 2 weeks old. He should be able to sleep by himself. I was like, I don't know what's going on. Everyone is so mad in this house. And it's at that moment where you see, really, the pressure is coming, and the baby is crying, and nobody knows why that baby is crying. And you're just starting to crumble. Everything starts to fall apart. And you spend all this time trying to piece things back together and drag it into this kind of same sort of place, but it's so difficult. It actually got so bad that me and my wife, we were, like the communication had broken down. We were fighting so much. It is really a miracle that our oldest son turned out so far okay. Though in the back of our minds, we're like, he's gonna snap one day. It's all the pressure we put on him. He's just gonna lose it. Please God, let there be a youth leader patient enough to deal with his trauma that we caused him. But there's this one time where my wife, we had another big fight, and she shouted at me, she's shouting at their son, and we're all shouting at each other, everyone's unhappy. And that night, and so I was, you know, so this is what happens after you have kids. You don't sleep in the same room together just because you don't like each other. shh, not really, it's the baby's fault. It's not, I mean, we love the baby too. Everything is great. Married, have children, have more children. That's the secret. I can only tell you what I've experienced. I will tell you the truth. That's all, okay. So what happened was I was staying in another room. My wife was sleeping in the good bed. And that night, she kind of had a dream, but actually it was probably a spiritual attack. And she saw this shadowy thing in the window, and it came with light on her. And she felt very spiritually oppressed, and she just started praying the name of Jesus. And eventually that left. And as soon as it left and she woke up, the first thing that came to her mind was, our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the spirits and powers of this evil world. And she understood immediately at the moment, this whole time, she's been fighting against her literal flesh and blood, me and our son, when actually the bigger battle was outside of that. And she, I think at that point, she realized, okay, we are not enemies. I am not her enemy. Our son is not her enemy. But actually, we are on the same team. We are actually supposed to be learning how to do this together. But actually, we really need to know who the Lord is, because there's a bigger battle going around outside of us. The hard part is when you are too busy or there's too much things going on, you just can't keep track of a bigger battle because you're just trying to put out the fires right in front of you. But if you don't start understanding actually who really is the Lord, who's really in charge, you will be so focused on these fires that you lose sight that you're actually in the middle of a giant blaze. See, when you start understanding all that kind of pressure and where that is important, you have to start saying, okay, God, I need to be able to hear and obey to set that foundation. With that saying, if you call him Lord, Lord, but you don't hear what he says or you don't build on that foundation, when the pressure comes, it's all gonna kind of collapse, it's all gonna fall apart. The key part for us then is Christians say, well, actually, I need to learn how to hear God, and I need to be active to obey it. I can't just say, I want to do things my way all the time. It's the hardest part to do, actually, because it really means you have to be humble. You have to admit you don't really know what's going on. You have to admit that things are beyond our control. One of the things that really helped us as parents is actually realizing we can't take too much credit if they turn out good, and we can't put too much blame on ourselves if they're going bad. We are responsible as parents to do our best in raising them. But then when you start seeing that God is bigger and their life journey is that with God, you start understanding what it means to surrender and to trust and to give that to him. When that passage says, so why do you keep calling me Lord, Lord, when you don't do what I say? I will show you what it's like when someone comes to me, listens to my teaching, and then follows it. To break it down, he says, it's like this. When someone comes to Jesus, listens to his teaching, then follows it. So that Marie Kondo woman and her organizational techniques, it's only good if you actually, you can watch the Netflix show, but if you don't listen to it or follow it, your life can still be a mess. It'll still be disorganized. Your clothes still won't be folded. It's the same with me and my wife. My wife keeps telling me, Bert, you should do this. You should organize your life this way. If I keep rejecting her, I keep ignoring that, those things that need to be fixed or changed don't get done. With Jesus, it's the same thing. You have to learn what it means. Well, what does it mean to actually come to Jesus? What does it mean to actually listen to what he says and then follow it? I think the hard part is this, actually, when we are too busy and there's too many things going on, when we think come to Jesus, that means I have to spend time praying and reading the Bible. When are you going to squeeze that time in? Where is that going to happen? What does it mean to listen to his teaching? Does it mean we have to listen to whoever is preaching on the Sunday, or does it mean just reading the Bible? Because sometimes it's difficult. You're trying to find even space to read the Bible, but as you're praying, when you're so busy And there's so many things going on. When you're praying, you can barely talk to God because all these other thoughts are popping to your head. You suddenly think about whether or not you've cleaned the toilet. You know, all sorts of random things come in. It becomes so difficult to hear God, to come to Him, and to even know how to slow down your life to walk in that kind of path. And that's the biggest challenge when your life is too full, when there's so many things pressing on you from all different directions. If we know that, actually, to sum this up, it's these three things, right? One, you have to go to God. Okay, that's the first thing. If you know you have to go to God, it's this thing where, okay, I really do have to say, I need to carve out time to be with Him. I need to find that space to do this. Working with university students has been kind of eye-opening. So there's a new generation of, our church is pretty interesting. A few years ago, we made a focus to stop, this might sound bad, but to stop focusing on international students, but try to reach just BBCs, because we felt like the BBCs were slipping out. They weren't going to churches. No one was reaching them on campus. There's a lot of international ministries, but after 3 years, they're gone again. So we said, let's focus on some BBCs. And the first year we had our BBCs, we had about 6 international students and like 3 BBCs. And they dealt with abortion and drugs. And I was like, let's just go back to those nice Singaporean and Malaysian students that are already Christians and can play guitar and just serve in worship. These BBCs are impossible. Like, I didn't know. And these were the Christian. These are the Christian BBCs who were, this was their lives. But we stuck with it. And our university group is, it's about 30 BBCs, actually. It's pretty unique in that they're all British-born Chinese. There's like one Malaysian who fits in very well with it. And not just that, we see the quality of their relationship with God has really shifted from the past. And it's really encouraging because that's what we want to see. But I was in the car and I was driving with them, and they were talking to me like, oh yeah, I mean, I was spending time with God this week reading the Bible. And I was like, oh. I felt slightly convicted. I'm a pastor. And I'm like, yeah, I know. But these guys are doing it devotionally. They're like, yeah, they're talking about that time spent together. And I wanted to say, yeah, it's because you're university students. You're so free. You have all that time. But I knew what the real answer was. It was like they wanted to spend time with God. And they felt like not spending time with God was detrimental to them. Like they loved it. They knew that they needed it. And I realized somewhere along the way, your life gets so busy, you start getting jaded or cynical about what it means to actually spend time devotionally with God. We don't know how to do it anymore. We don't even know how to spend time closely with our spouses. We don't know what it means to spend time with God anymore. But actually, it is so important to do that.
I don't know where I was anymore. Oh, I'm hearing God. I was telling the story about my wife. Oh, I was telling a story about how we had a second child and then how bad that was. I mean, how great. Yeah, I'm so joyful. So I think the hardest part about this was that the relationship between my wife and I started to break down in terms of the ability to have conversations with each other. Everything you talk about is about the health or the well-being of the child, and it's just about trying to get it's all management. Everything is a conversation about management. Who's doing this? What's going on with this? Have you washed the bottles? Did you sterilize them? Where are they? What's going on with this? How much water is there? Did you pack the food? Did you bring the food? What school are they going to? Did you apply for those things? And it's just nonstop management all the time. And because of that, the actual relationship between my wife and I start to really fall apart. You stop knowing, like, who they are. It sounds funny, but you start losing track of why they're beautiful or why they're wonderful. You start losing track of what their relationship with God is like, because you guys don't get to go to this church at the same time. One person has to stay with a child and the other one doesn't. On top of that, there is growing resentment because one person is always telling the other person what to do and the other person just has to stay silent. By the way, for those of you who don't have kids, it's wonderful. You should have many babies. It's so good. None of these parents have any problems that I have had. They don't understand. Their lives were beautiful and wonderful the whole way through. Okay, just go have babies now. I don't mind. Just go. My room has many beds. Okay. These are all grown-ups in here, right? This is so. All right, in short, what I'm trying to say is that actually, you can, it's very easy to actually lose the intimacy in a relationship with someone when you lose that ability to communicate. And without knowing it, you just stop knowing how to engage or talk to or understand them. Our problem is we've let the same thing happen to God. When our lives become too busy or too many things to manage, you no longer know what it's like to be close to God. Now, this is a big deal, actually, because then when the pressure comes, when the storm comes, things start to crumble and you don't know how to keep afloat. In fact, what you see a lot of times is the pressure comes and then you're just like, okay, I just don't even have time to go to church anymore. I don't have time to pray. And then you start just getting used to doing things your own way, but you're not getting any better at life. It just always feels like things are out of control. When we don't realize that actually, if we're calling Jesus Lord, you really have to start with him. You have to say, actually, you are the one who has the words of life. You are the one who is true. I'm going to trust, God, that if you say that if I'm looking to you first, you're going to help me bring everything back into order. Because that's essentially what God is saying. If you build your life on his foundation, when the pressure comes, you'll be able to stand. It's actually been really good. So my wife, it took about 10 years. So the first 10 years of our marriage was really rough, but the past 5 years have been much better. And one of the big keys is we found that the more we start to learn how to love God and engage with each other more, the burden and the pressure of the things we thought we had to be in control of is released. We don't hold on to our children as tightly as we thought because we know that actually we have to trust God so much for that. Our job, our work, we don't hold on to that as tightly as we can. Even the success that we want or the things that we hope we can achieve in our lives, you start realizing actually in God's perspective, being able to lean on him opens the doorway for a much better path with him than if you're just trying to fight for yourself. The hard part is we're always just trying to survive. We don't have that space to actually say, okay, God, I've got this oriented wrong. See, if we don't know what it means to go to God, we won't be able to hear him. Your relationship breaks down. If you can't hear God, if you don't know what it's like to love him, then it becomes very difficult then to say, okay, actually, God, what do you want me to do? You'll just go back to your old way of doing things. I watched the Marie Kondo video once, and I forgot now what's the best way to fold the clothes. I know when I watched it, I'm like, oh, you fold it like this, third, something like this. 5 minutes later, I've completely forgotten how to do it. I'd have to watch it multiple times to really get used to it. Actually, with God, it's the same thing. You will forget what he said. You forget what's going on, and you need that daily space with him. And it is talking with your spouse and saying, okay, I think this is important. What's a good time for me to do this? Will you be okay if I have 15, 20 minutes on my own to do this? And it's between both of you. And if you're yourself, if you're not married, you have no kids, you have to start getting in that habit now. It's very easy to just go ahead and sail through your life and just be like, well, I'll see whatever happens, whatever job comes up, wherever I go. But if you aren't used to that, you won't be able to hear God in any kind of respect. The last part, of course, is really just to obey him. If you don't obey, if you hear what he says, but you just don't obey, then you're just back to square one. Like my wife tells me all the time to tidy my wardrobe. I completely ignore her. And at some point, I can't tell which clothes are clean and which clothes are dirty. But I'm a guy, I don't care, right? But my wife cares because I smell. I don't know, because I smell myself. I don't think I smell bad, but everyone else does. I think probably the best example of this is every Sunday before I go to church, I can dress myself, but not with any style. So the reason I'm wearing this jumper is because my wife went to work and I just thought, I need all my warm clothes. So I just brought all the warm clothes I have based on Alex Chow's recommendation. Now I'm sweating all the time because I only have this one warm jumper. And I brought all my like thermal clothes. I obviously not prepared. And I didn't ask my wife for any of this. But I know on Sundays there have been times where I'm about to leave the house and my wife will look at me and say, are you wearing that? You know, that none of that matches. It's like, what? This doesn't match? He says, no, it looks horrible. And now I'm always at this moment. There's this moment where I can stop and say, whatever. Nobody cares. It's fine. But I know my wife is much better than me, so I immediately go upstairs and change. And I'll have to ask her, is this okay? She says, are you even trying? I was like, I don't know. Can you just tell me what to wear? I can't tell. They all look the same to me. And it's, again, it's one of those things where if I don't obey her in that circumstance, I will survive. It'll be fine. But it is much better if I do. In the same way in your relationship with God, if you hear him, if you're learning how to hear him again, if you're reading the Bible and then you're not obeying him, you're gonna be in trouble. Now, when we talk about hearing and obeying, I think a lot of times we're still stuck in this thought where like, okay, well, he's going to tell me to go to this shop or he's going to tell me to buy this food. God is less concerned with those things. He's more concerned with your character, with your heart, with your attitude, the way you treat other people. And it's that what you really got to listen out to. You know, when you're talking about hearing God and you're talking about obeying him, when he's telling you to forgive or to be gracious or to speak in love, you have to respond in that way. Our problem is when the pressure comes, it's not about whether the work goes bad. When the pressure comes, you start treating the people around you a lot worse. You bring that stress home. The way you talk to people, you're more agitated, you're more angry. The way you deal with things, and you bring that home when you treat your family that way, you treat your kids, you talk to your parents that way, and all that aspect, you start realizing, oh, actually, because I don't go to God, I don't hear what he's saying about what I really need to be like, and I'm not obeying him. The worst part about all of that is when you're doing that, you are slowly undermining and destroying the relationships you have here. You can imagine that as cracks in the walls of a house. And at some point, that pressure makes those relationships fall apart. You know, they just aren't as connected. You lose that kind of space. My son's a little bit older now. He's 11, so we have we can have more conversations about different things. And he will tell me, oh, I remember when you tried to teach me this maths. He's now in secondary school. And he's doing math now that I was trying to teach him when he was 5. He said, oh, I remember when you tried to teach me this when you were 5. And then I cried. Because I got really agitated. And I was speaking very loudly. Okay, I was shouting at him because he wasn't learning the math. He didn't understand it fast enough. And I said, oh, yeah, I remember that. I'm sorry, Alex. I'm a bad dad. I'm really sorry. He said, it's okay. I understand. You were just trying to help me. Such a good kid. And I'm like, you know. I'm like, no, actually, Oscar, Alex, it's totally wrong. And it's one of those things where, you know, if you are feeling stressed or under pressure, you're not at peace with God and you're not at peace with others, you start treating people differently, and that has its repercussions. You don't know how to discipline your children in grace, in fairness, but also strongly. You don't know how to speak to your wife in love and not out of bitterness or feelings of insecurity. Instead, you just find yourself just trying to get the tasks done, but not actually understanding how those tasks are getting done. Like, we sacrifice so much of the quality of our soul and our relationships for the wrong kind of things. When we talk about hearing and going and obeying God, it's really saying, okay, God, if I don't let my soul be in a place where it is rested with you, I will not be able to treat the people around you, around me, with any of that grace or that love. It's, in our family, it's gone a lot better, but we can tell when our kids know when we're more stressed. We'll speak to them more abruptly or harsher. My wife will message me and say, I was very grumpy today. And I think the kids know that. And it's at that point where we're like really saying, okay, we really have to, you need to go to God. You need to have some time. You have a time out with God. But really for that relationship to be restored. So there is in our family, less so now because I don't think we're as bad, but we used to have to do a lot of apologizing to our kids. Like, okay, actually, I'm sorry. I wasn't mad at you. I was just mad and I shouted at you and it's not right. because a lot of times we're just mad at them for no reason. And you're probably the same way with the people around you, and your work colleagues, or maybe your boss is mad at you and you bring that home and you bring someone else that way. It's again this saying, well, okay, God, if I'm coming to you, I'm trusting that you're helping me to get my character in the right place. Calling Jesus Lord, Lord, and saying you obey him is really saying, you know, I am choosing to trust you. I'm choosing to trust you in the way you say how we're supposed to live, how you will care for my soul, how you will nurture me and help me to change my character to be better than I was before and more like you. God's desire is for us not to do the same things he does, but to become more and more like him in his character and his soul and his heart. And we need to be asking ourselves, how do we make that more evident and more real in the relationships around us? It's this idea of actually saying, God, actually, I want you to be the builder in my life. You're the one who is building me up. And this is where I want to come then to kind of finish off with, to Psalm 127. Psalm 127 is most commonly used by churches in a church building project. I don't know why, because it has the word building in it, and they want to try to convince people to give money, but also to not feel bad about saying, oh, if you're not donating money, you're not letting God build his house. Ah, Chinese people. Actually, it's not, I wish it was just a Chinese thing, but I'm pretty sure all churches use this passage in the same kind of guilt-tripping way. Guilt-tripping works across all cultures, but we have more shame and honor involved. So the passage goes like this: unless the Lord builds a house, the work of the builders is wasted. Unless the Lord protects the city, guarding it with sentries will do no good. And if we're thinking about what it means to trust God, what it means to let him be the builder of our life, what we think about means for our relationships, this first part, this is really about surrender. You cannot be the one in charge of building your house. You cannot be the one in charge of defending your house. If we say your house is your household, or even your own life, or your own career, or your own character, you're really saying, actually, God, I surrender my life, my desires, my household, my family, I give that to you. And I want you to be the one building this house. So the work of the builder is not wasted. Like, I think about this a lot in terms of our church. And I would tell Fan, I feel like I'm wasting my, what if I've wasted my time here? What if the work of the, you know, what if my work here amounts to nothing? And she always reminds me, it's not your church. You know, it's God's church. It's not your people, it's God's people. And you understand that sense of being afraid that something's gonna be wasted. What if I pour all this life into my marriage or into my kids and they come out a mess? It's when you're trying to hold on to those things so tightly, you lose sight of actually who is the one really in charge. I like it because actually when we talk about the work that you're trying to build, it ties in so closely with this idea of who's protecting it. When it's our own thing, we're trying to protect it so much because we feel like we have the most to lose. But God is saying you have to trust him that he's the one building it. And actually, he has the most to lose if you go off the rails. And so he wants you to trust him. That word is there is surrender. It's actually choosing, actually, God, you are the builder of my household, of my children, of my marriage, of my family, of my future, of my career, of whether I get married or not, how long I live, how my life is lived out. I surrender that to you. The passage goes on. It is useless for you to work so hard from early morning until late at night, anxiously working for food to eat, for God gives rest to his loved ones. And a lot of you, I'm sure you know what this is like. You work so hard, you're up early, you're late at night, and you're working. And it says for food to eat, but most of us here are not in that place where we are so destitute, you know, we don't have enough food to eat. But yet we're still anxiously working so hard to make sure that happens. And so ironic because God is saying God gives rest to his loved ones. If you know you are loved, you will know that you are secure and you are safe and you are protected and you will have rest. You know, before our kids go to bed and they come and we hug each other and they're so happy and they're so at peace and they just take their soft toys and they go to bed, we always know, man, these kids, they have it too good. We should introduce some suffering into their life. No. You know, like they know that they are safe and they are warm and they are protected and they have that place of rest. Whereas sometimes we have bad sleep because we're worried about tomorrow, or worried about a meeting we have, or worried about what's happened that day, that we don't have that peace. Actually, one thing that God really desires us to know and understand is his rest, that peace that comes with him. If we know that first part is this idea of surrender, the second thing is actually, God, will you help me to rest? Will you help me to make sure I am getting good rest? Being a pastor, pastor is a weird kind of job. No one really knows what you kind of do. They think you come down to Jesus work on Sundays, but they expect you to be there for them whenever they need something. I've started to be a lot more strict about making sure I don't work on Mondays. So that's my Sabbath. And the other thing I've started doing more aggressively is not saying yes to everyone or responding to everyone's immediate WhatsApp request. Most of the time, because actually they're gonna figure it out themselves. You don't really need me at this moment to tell you whether you should go out with this person or not. So you're gonna do it anyways. That's like, why even message me, like, for my permission? I don't care. I care deeply because I'm a pastor. Anyways, I've been being more strict about that. And people say, and people ask me, oh yeah, you must be really busy as a pastor. I said, no, I'm. There's a lot of things that I'm doing, but I'm also make sure I don't overcommit. Like, I try my hardest not to overcommit. And they say, oh, why? That's good that you do that. I said, well, if I'm going to teach my congregation that they should also have rest, I can't be the kind of pastor who's doing everything all the time and making everyone else in the church feel bad that they're not also serving the church. And because I said, it's very important. Now, what's funny is the last few weeks, I have been bad. I've been working on Mondays. I've done some visitations. And I've told myself it's because there's been these more urgent things that have come up, you know. But I know actually what's happened was I just said yes to them. Whereas they would have been happy to rearrange for any other day, I just said yes. Partially because it made me feel like I was contributing their life or more needed, or that I could do something to fix their situation, or I needed to be there to help them for that. All that was doing was saying, actually, God, I don't trust you enough that you think rest is important. I think that somehow I need to be in all those places at once. And it's really hard to accept the idea that God is saying you should rest. It is important for you, for your life's pacing. You need to make sure you do that. And it's one of those things where you actually have to say, okay, God, if I know that's what you said, and I hear you, I have to obey you in this. I have to make sure I find that place where I can rest. And for me, a lot of times that rest isn't saying strictly I just have to make sure I don't work on Monday, but I know I have to make space. My brain is not overly focused on these things that make me anxious or worried. It is actively saying, actually, God, I'm letting those things go, and I'm trusting you with my career, with my job, with my boss, with my relationships. I'm just going to have that place. Now, obviously, that applies to work. It's a lot harder when you try to apply it to your family and your spouse and your children. So I really wanted rest for my children this past summer. They came with me to the States. My wife stayed. I had to look after them extra more, and I told my wife, I'm really tired. I really need a break. And she just kind of just kept going on in life, and I was like, no, I don't think you understand, honey. I'm really tired. Like, I think I hate my children now. I think I hate you. It's really like, I do love them, but if I see them, I want to run away. I don't think you understand. And she didn't understand, because she just said, no, what's fine? Because she doesn't spend as much time with them. So I'm like, no, I'm really. And then we had this massive row in the airport, like a really bad row. And we hadn't had a big fight in a couple years, which is really good for us, because we used to fight like all the time. So really big row, really bad, really a lot of regretful things said in a public place, both from lack of sleep. And afterwards, my wife has now been fearful that I'm just going to explode and lose it again. And now I was trying to tell her, actually, a lot of it's my fault because I didn't make space to rest from even the family. It doesn't mean that I'm not there with them, but again, that whole idea of rest is really surrendering that to God. And then saying, I don't always need to be there and respond right away. because most of the time they will figure out how to use the glue or the tape themselves, and if it makes a mess, it's not that bad. It's not the end of the world. I can still clean it before my wife gets home. It's okay. You know, like, and then my wife keeps telling me, Bert, you don't always have to make a feast for dinner. You could just fry noodles once. You don't have to make it so elaborate. I was like, well, I have time. And it's really saying, actually, God, I am trusting you with these things so that I know I will be able to rest. And this is where I come to the next part. And I always thought this was really weird that they start adding this. The Lord builds the house, and, you know, and then the Lord gives rest, and then suddenly children. Like, what's the deal with the children? Why do you have to bring, it was going so well. Children are a gift from the Lord. They are a reward from him. Children born to a young man are like arrows in a warrior's hand. I just thought, what does that mean? What does an arrow in a warrior's hand mean? You know, what's the children? Because I feel like I'd rather shoot them sometimes, but not in that way. And this is where all my backhanded compliments towards my children gets convicted, because actually what he's really saying is you have to be able to rejoice in the gifts that God has given you. Children being one of them, you really have to rejoice. Now, maybe I've been in Britain too long, but we like to say really passive-aggressively negative comments about everything. Oh, it's so cold today, isn't it? Oh, it's too hot today, isn't it? You know, like you're never happy. And I bring that same kind of attitude into my work, into my relationships, even into my children. But actually, there needs to be this spirit where you say, actually, you know what? I'm really rejoicing. No matter what the circumstance of our children's are like, whether they're healthy or whether they're going through hard times, you have to be rejoicing in that. And it's something that, I think my wife and I are trying to proactively do, to be more joyful with them, to be more rejoicing the fact that they are there. When I look back at the way my Chinese parents raised me, they don't say I love you, they don't hug you. The dad doesn't speak to you, almost just gives money to the mom who gives it to you. And then every now and then you have to bow to them. And then there's a lot of food. And it's funny because I know that they love me, but there wasn't still that same sense of rejoicing. The flip side for our kids, sometimes we say, do we love our kids too much? We always tell them we're proud of them. They didn't do anything. You know, how proud, you know, are we over loving them? Do they feel like, and you start getting worried, but actually that what God is trying to teach us is actually, no, you should let them know the joy that you, how much joy you have in God because of them, for them to be there, for them to be part of your life. And when we start putting it in the focus of God as opposed to what I'm trying to teach them in their life, what I'm trying to show them, it's more than I'm not rejoicing that they exist. I'm rejoicing in God for the family he's given me. I'm rejoicing in God for the time we spend together. I'm rejoicing in God even in the struggles that they have. And this is in, it's talking about children there specifically, but it's also making you think, actually, there needs to be a greater sense of rejoicing in what God has given to you in your life. We complain a lot more than we need to. We're dissatisfied a lot more often than we need to be, especially when we start comparing what we have with someone else or comparing your children with someone else. You lose the ability to rejoice. Actually, God is really helping us to rejoice. Then the arrows analogy finally goes a little bit further and says, how joyful is the man whose quiver is full of those arrow children. He will not be put to shame when he confronts his accuser at the city gates. So cryptic, right? So Confucius. I don't know what they're trying to say. Until I understood, the thing about arrows are it's not a bow, right? The arrows are put in the bow in your lodge. By the way, for Valentine's Day, my wife was like, oh, so let's go do archery, because my wife likes archery. So she booked like this archery. I was like, I don't want to go archery. This is totally because you want to do archery. And then we can shoot crossbows as well. And then we went to go do this archery. And it's like, we shot a couple, and it's like, oh, this is kind of fun. And the guy showed us, oh, yeah, this would go right through you. Like, this arrow would just slice right through you. I was like, and then we suddenly got really scared, like, oh, these are real weapons. These are like, I got a massive bruise on my arm. I was like, I don't want to do it. And then, yeah, anyways. So the thing about arrows are when you draw the bow and then you shoot the arrow, the arrow goes flying, and there's a sense of releasing. So even when you're talking about going to the gates, and you know all the enemies will be there, you can't hold on to an arrow forever. The whole point of an arrow is to be released, is to be let go. And there's a sense actually of this need to be releasing of even the gifts that God has given you. In this case, they're talking about the way we care for our children. It's not so that we hold on to them so they just do what we want to do or live in our life forever, but there's a sense that we are joyful because we'll be releasing them to be a blessing elsewhere and blessing outwards. When we think about actually all the things that God has given us, if we hold on to them too tightly, we become protective, or we think this is our house that we're building. But actually what God is trying to help us understand is, no, he's the builder, and the gifts he gives us is to be released, to be a blessing, to let that rejoicing be shared out, as opposed to just holding on to things so tightly. Thinking about in that perspective not just helps you be a more balanced parent or a friend, but you start having a different picture of who's building and why he's building this way. Looking at all of this and thinking about our relationship with God, it makes us actually have to stop and step back and say, okay, well, and I think this is helpful to do every now and then, you stop and take stock of your life. And the first way, when we ever take stock of our life, we always start by looking at what we have or what we don't have. I have no spouse, or I do have a spouse, or I have two spouses, hopefully not in this place. I have children, I have a house, I have a car, I have a job. And then we start thinking, I would rather have this job. But actually, you need to stop and take stock of what's in front of you. And I'm talking about the physical things. And you stop and you say, okay, God, well, first of all, these are all yours. You're the one who gave these to me in the first place. I prayed that you would give me this job, and you gave me this job. And now I regret having this job, but I did pray for it in the beginning with my children, my spouse. I prayed for all of these things. And the first thing is, and when you release them, you say, okay, God, well, you're the one who gave all those to me. I am responsible to be faithful to you in these things, but they are yours. And then when you look at that space, you start realizing, okay, God, how am I treating each of these things? What's my relationship to them? Am I selfish? Am I self-absorbed? Am I overly critical? Am I rejoicing? Or am I bitter or frustrated? And then you have to say, okay, God, in my relationship with you then, how do you want me to view each of these things? How do you want my relationship with these things to glorify and exalt you so that you are able to build? See, the thing is, if you stand back and you continue to get hard-hearted and selfish and trying to produce these things yourself, you discover that your relationship with them and the relationship with all these things becomes slightly distorted. But you need to actually stop and say, actually, God, actually, I need to learn how to love this person, or I need to learn how to love in these circumstances, or I need to become more patient in this. I need to become more understanding in this so that your character and who you are gets shaped so that the Lord's building can continue to grow and develop. Because if our life is too full of these objects, we get lost and think that those are the most important things. But we need to step back and say, actually, God, this is my situation. Where are you in this? What do you want me to do? How do you want me to move forward in this? I think the hardest part in all of this is actually trusting that God is faithful and he's good. I think we all know that he is. But we want him to be that way in a certain way. I know God is good and I can trust him, but I would like him to do it where I am safe and secure and I make a lot of money and my kids grow up and do really well in school and then get good jobs. That's how we think. That's what we think when we say, I trust God, he will fulfill my dreams. But to really trust God is to say, God, whatever circumstance happens, I know that you can be glorified in this. And above all, I want you to be glorified in all of these things. I'm not worried about the situation, but I want you to be glorified. When you look at it that way, it helps to shift your perspective. And with a story, not about my family. There is a COCM's previous general director, Mary Wong, amazing woman. I had the privilege of spending some time with her working with COCM, and she'd come and speak to me. She spoke very slowly. She's amazing. She really helped pioneer planting a lot of churches. You can debate whether or not how they did it was a good or a bad way, but regardless, her love for this nation, for China's nation, was amazing. And then as she got older, she was still serving. She served God her whole life since she was like a nurse, and God called her out. And it was, and then she slipped in the bathroom one day, and then she fell down. She broke her hip, and then she suddenly had dementia. She got dementia. And the last like 15 years of her life, she had dementia. And I remember when I heard about that, I said to God, God, this is so unfair. Like, she served you with her whole life, and she's going to have dementia now, and she's going to not remember anything. And one of the most distinct things about her, she remembered everything. She could remember the details of, like, what someone was wearing in a conversation with them about some subject. And now that's, like, all taken away from her because of dementia. And I was asking God, God, that's just not fair. And I was saying that on one hand for her benefit, but on the flip side, I was thinking very selfishly, God, I don't want to work for you my whole life and then get dementia. That's not fair. I want to die peacefully in my sleep. Like, I'm not prepared to suffer for you. I mean, maybe martyrdom, if it's quick and pain, like quick pain, that's fine. But like dementia, that's like the worst way to go. Like, you don't even know what's happening, and someone's got to care for your burden on society. I was like, God, it's not fair. And I was really wrestling with God about this because I thought, I don't want to be in full-time ministry if there's no guarantee of, like, of course, that makes no sense since, like, most of the people in the Bible were martyred. But in my head, I'm like, I didn't sign up for this. And then God spoke in my heart, and he said, if one person comes to know Christ through Mary's suffering, would it be worth it? Even if she had suffered the last, 10, 15 years of her life that way, would it still be worth it? If one person through that testimony could become a Christian. I thought about that. I said, technically, I guess so. Yes, I suppose it should be worth it. But there was that conflict where I was like, God, no, I think I know the best way to build a life. And having it end like that is not the right way. And God was saying, you think so short term. You don't really know what's good. You have to trust the master builder. If it's my desire for Mary to do this, but it will glorify me more in the future, when Mary's in heaven in eternity, do you think she's going to complain about that last 15 years of her life if she sees what glory it brought him? And I think after realizing that, it started to make me understand what it means to really surrender your life to God. What it means to surrender your future, your children, your job, your present, and say, well, God, you're a lot smarter than me, and you're also outside of time. So it would be foolish of me not to trust you and not to surrender my own hopes and dreams to you, knowing that you can bring something greater for your glory out of that. I think for all of us, that's something we have to start wrestling with and start thinking, okay, God, what does it mean to say, yeah, maybe I had these ambitions, and maybe they're still good ambitions, but God, my greatest ambition is that your name can be glorified and exalted through my life in whatever way possible. Shall we pray, and then the worship team will come up, and then I have some questions for small groups afterwards. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, you know, we know that you are good, and you are this perfect example of someone who gives their life fully and wholly. Even though you knew the end would not be, the temporal end was not glorious, you knew the eternal end was. And God, I know for us, because we are bound by time, we are so fixed on what we can accomplish or what we'd like to accomplish or how we want things to turn out, that we lose sight of actually that Jesus, you are much more trustworthy. You are much more good. And to be honest, I think for a lot of us, we've actually lost lost sight of this relationship with you. We know about you. We know that you exist. We come to church. But our relationship with you has gone a bit dry. It's gone a bit quiet. Will you use the time this weekend to let us get to know you again, to let our hearts seek you again, to find that rest, to find that rejoicing, to see what things you want us to surrender, so that we know that you can have that access and the freedom and the authority to be building in our life again, Lord. Take control of all the things that we're trying to hold on to that's leaving us empty. Instead, we want to put those at your feet and just saying, okay, God, you show us, you teach us. We are ready to hear and obey. We thank you in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.